Your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
CKUT.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune into the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, and every second Thursday of the month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means. Do you? It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number, you weren't a man, you want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Virginia, and I'm your host for today's show. Today, you're going to hear from Naomi Berlin, who is a founder of the Write On Project. We'll be talking to her about the letter writing project she founded and the data they have gathered about issues facing prisoners in Canada. After that, we are going to air some edited audio from Kiteline Radio in the United States. They edited audio from a talk featuring Ruth Wilson Gilmore and James Kilgore, where Gilmore and Kilgore are talking about ankle bracelets and other forms of electronic monitoring related to Kilgore's book, Understanding E-Carceration. This snippet of a longer talk feels very relevant here in the years following an increase in the use of electronic monitoring in Canada, especially for immigration-related cases. Finally, we will be sharing a short interview with an organizer from Solidarity Across Borders about a vigil they are organizing this coming Sunday to commemorate and honor those who have died in the migrant prison, including one person who died on January 30th of this year. We will share more information about that vigil later on in the show. First up, here is our interview with Naomi Berlin of the Write On Project. So thank you so much, first of all, for agreeing to do this interview. I think the project that you guys are working on is really cool, and I'm excited to share it with the people who listen to our show, which includes a lot of people on the inside. So I was wondering to start if you could introduce yourself for our listeners and explain a little bit what the Write On Project is.
Yeah, sure. So my name is Naomi Berlin. So I founded Write On in, I guess, 2018. So we are just a loose group of volunteers. We're not incorporated or anything like that. We have no funding. And we correspond with people who are incarcerated in Canada, and we respond to their request for information. Because as I'm sure you know, when you're in prison, it's very hard to access information. You have no access to the internet. You have limited access to books, written materials, and so on. So, yeah, we have so far answered about 430 letters, and we received our first letters in June of 2019.
Do you mind telling us a bit about how the project got started? Like, what's the story behind it?
I've always had concerns about the prison system and the criminal justice system in general. You know, there's just so many problems with it. It's very humane. It's very unjust. And I don't think it accomplishes much overall. So in 2015, 2016, I took a year off from my regular life in Toronto, and I went to the San Francisco Bay Area, and I volunteered with two groups that, like, advocate for prisoners. And I met many, many different groups there that all advocate for prisoners in different ways. And one thing I learned was that all these groups received mail from prisoners, often lots and lots of mail, and the letters were always asking for information about all kinds of different topics, such as legal information, information about services, programs, all kinds of stuff. And these groups were just struggling to, you know, be able to respond to all these letters. And that's where I learned that prisoners have very little access to information, no access to the internet and so on. So that's why they're reaching out to these groups to get this information that they needed. And then when I came back to Toronto, I really wanted to start some kind of group that would offer some kind of support to people who are incarcerated. And I guess from my experience in San Francisco, I thought, well, maybe prisoners here have the same issue with, you know, lack of access to information. So maybe we could correspond with prisoners and be willing to supply them with the information that they request. And I did a lot of research. I talked to a lot of people who are in the know, people who have worked with prisoners or are familiar with the system. And they all said, yeah, but it's the same issue here. So that's how we got started. And I found some volunteers, and we had our first meeting, I think, in October 2018. And then by June of 2019, we started receiving our first letters.
So you mentioned that you guys have received some 400-plus letters at this point, and from the emails that you've been sending out, it looks like you've compiled a lot of data through your correspondence. I'm wondering if you could talk about what prisoners have been asking for in those 400 letters and what your data sets have shown in terms of what's going on in prisons in Canada.
Yeah, sure. So, we did collect information about, you know, what prisoners are asking about. Like, we divided it into various themes, and I can just read you out what we found from, I guess this is the first 303 letters we received. So about 30% of the letters request some kind of legal information. It seems a lot of them are working on their legal cases. So often they'll ask for past court cases or definitions of certain legal terms. They also ask for other things like prison rules and policies, what their rights are. And then 15% of the letters ask for pen pal services. It seems like there's just a lot of loneliness and isolation in prison. I mean, people seem like they're really hungry for human contact. 18% of the letters ask for resources and services in the community, either resources and services that they can use inside prison or for when they are released. 9% ask about educational programs. A lot of them seem to want to pursuing like post-secondary education of some kind, so they ask about that. 9% of the letters requested information on various careers. So a lot of them seem to be making plans for what kind of career they want to pursue when they're released. So they ask about that. A lot of them also ask us about starting their own business. And I'll also mention, we don't really have a stat for this one, but many prisoners just ask us for stuff to do. It can be reading materials, crossword puzzles, instructions for card games, yoga and exercises, pictures to color, jokes. It seems like a lot of them just don't really have a lot to do inside.
Yeah. So we found out about your project because you guys have started an email campaign that you've titled Letters from the Inside, Unanswered Questions. And based on the data that you've figured out, you have some unanswered questions for the government. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about those questions and kind of who they're directed at.
Yeah, sure. So I guess the questions are directed to whoever's in power, whoever has power to change the system. So that would likely be the government. We also sent this document we created to the superintendent, the people in charge of the prisons where we get a lot of mail from. So I don't know how much power they have, but we can send it to them as well. So I'll just go over the questions that we asked. You know, probably the main one is, why do prisoners lack access to the internet and other information sources? I mean, a lot of the information they request of us would obviously be very helpful to them. You know, they're making plans for their future, for when they get out. They also want to just learn about a lot of topics, expand their mind, and so on. And why are prisoners so, another question is, why is prisoners so why are prisoners so cut off from the outside world? And what does this accomplish? And when I mean they're cut off, A, just being so cut off from accessing information, from knowing what's going on in the outside world. But also I know that, you know, getting, a lot of them are very lonely and isolated. I know staying in contact with people on the outside can be hard. You know, they don't have email, or they, you know, they don't have the internet, so they can't, you know, use any kind of means that way to communicate with people. They don't have access to cell phones. I think all phone calls are limited to 20 minutes. And I know for people to come visit them, it's very restricted. There's a lot of rules. So there's just this sense of people there being just so cut off and isolated. And why is that? And what is that going to accomplish? And another question we have is, why is there a need for our services? Because it seems like we're filling a gap that's not being met, accessing information. And, you know, we're just a small group with very limited resources. So why are the prisons not supplying them with this information, which obviously is very helpful to them, can benefit them, can help prepare them, you know, for life on the outside? And the last question is, well, what is the purpose of prison? This is one I often wonder about. Like, is it just to punish people and make them suffer? Is that all it is? Or is it to help them, you know, become better individuals, help them grow, develop, deal with their issues? Because, you know, a lot of prisoners come from very difficult backgrounds. And is it to help them prepare to reenter the community? Because most of them will. And if it's, you know, if the purpose of prison is to help them prepare to leave in a better situation, then it seems, you know, they're not doing a great job, is at least the sense I get.
So I'm curious, you mentioned that you've sent these letters, or the questions that you have, you've sent them to members of the government, you've sent them to administrators at different prisons, you've also been sending them out over various listservs, and so they seem to be a bit of a popular education tool as well. I'm curious, what kinds of responses have you gotten from your letters so far?
Oh, okay. I can't talk about the responses we've gotten from members of the government, because those were just people were just contacted recently, and I do have to check in with the volunteer who sent them out, but it's probably a bit too early to know. But we sent the document out to a lot of different social justice groups, and, you know, the response has been very positive. That's where a lot of people said it was really interesting. There's been people who want to join our group because of it. And I sent it out to a lot of media and journalists, and we got some response there too. A couple of magazines suggested we write an op-ed, and that we submit it to them. So we're working on an op-ed. I was interviewed yesterday by a journalist who writes a column for the Toronto Star, and she wants to write about the mistreatment of prisoners. What else? I talked to another journalist from the Star who says he may be interested in doing a feature on us. So we have gotten some good feedback.
that answers a little bit my next question, but what do you guys have next on the agenda for your group? Are you onboarding a bunch of new volunteers? Are you hoping to expand the number of letters you can send out? Like, what's in the works?
I don't know about expanding, just because we have no, you know, our resources are limited. We're all volunteers, so how much we can expand, I don't know. But, you know, we do recruit new volunteers probably 2 to 3 times a year, you know, because people do come and go. So, yeah, if anybody's, you know, interested in joining us, for sure they can contact us. If they just Google, I think, Write On, as in WRITE, On Prisoners, they'll find our website. Other than that, like, I personally am interested a lot in advocacy, and I hope we do continue, you know, some advocacy efforts. And one thing I'd love to do is team up with other groups that advocate for prisoners, and see if there's any projects we can do together.
And then, I don't know if you have this on hand, but if there's any prisoners listening who want to write to you guys, what's the mailing address where they can reach you all?
234-110 Cumberland Street. That's Cumberland Street, Toronto, Ontario, M53V5. And they can just address the letter to Write On, as in WRITE and then ON.
Great.
Two different ones.
Thanks so much for doing this really short interview.
You're welcome.
Good luck with the project. It sounds like you guys are doing interesting things.
Thank you. And thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. That was our interview with Naomi Berlin of the Write On Project. If you want to reach out and write to them, you can go to their website at writeonprisoners.wixsite.com/writeon, or you can reach out to them at suite number 234, 110 Cumberland Street, Toronto, Ontario, M5R3V5.
Sleeping.
That was the song Anything by Adrian Lenker. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. Up next, we're going to share audio we got from Kiteline Radio. In case you haven't heard of them, Kiteline is a weekly radio show about prison issues, mostly in the United States. This was part of their episode that aired on January 28th.
This week, we continue to air selections from a presentation moderated by Ruth Wilson Gilmore and featuring James Kilgore speaking on his new book, Understanding Ecarceration. Speaking from his own experience, he emphasizes that electronic monitoring is another euphemism for the expansion of the carceral net across the globe, enriching corporations and shackling prisoners, often at their own expense, from the U.S. to Palestine to South Africa. He talks about the gender disparities that arise because the toll that electronic monitoring often takes on family members, people, often mothers, daughters, partners, and sisters, who are tasked against their will with becoming, as Gilmore puts it, unsworn deputies. Gilmore and Kilgore talk about their prison abolition work in both California and Illinois. And Kilgore argues that we must expose the reality of incarceration and include the struggles of the monitored in the broader horizon of abolition. Here they are.
Let me ask you this. You were talking about this thing called the cloud. Could you lay out for us a quick sketch of what the cloud is and why we should be aware of as well as wary about this thing called the cloud?
Okay. So before I do that, everybody should look up. If you look up at the sky, you'll see the cloud there, right? I mean, it's that word kind of is kind of confusing. I don't even know whether to say it's in the cloud, on the cloud, whatever. But I mean, the cloud is basically a big, I mean, to make it real simple, it's basically a big hard drive. You know, it's basically a big Google Drive that's gathering databases from all kinds of sources. But the bulk of the cloud is owned by Amazon, Google, and Microsoft. So basically, when immigration is sending data, when the criminal justice system is sending data, when companies are sending data, it's going to the cloud, and then the companies do what they will with it. So they can use mathematical formulas, algorithms to use that data to track certain people, to maybe predict their behavior, to track certain companies or industries to see where they might invest in the future. There's a whole range of ways in which they're using this information to benefit themselves, but also to heighten the control that they have over populations, particularly the targeted populations.
Mm-hmm. Now, this sounds so overwhelming, again, because it's so big. So I'd like to ask you to talk to us about some of the ways that you see people have brought themselves together, perhaps created solidarities because of the general threat of constant and intensive and extensive surveillance as you understand it.
You know, a lot of the work has really focused on unpacking some popular education, say by the Lucy Parsons Lab in Chicago, has done a really excellent job of trying to unpack, first figuring out what is all the surveillance technology that Cook County in Illinois uses, and then being able to popularly describe what it does, who it targets, and how you might contest that. And I mean, one of the things about this that's also overwhelming and complicated is the information is hard to get, right? Even on something as simple as an electronic monitor, companies are not held accountable. So they don't write reports, they don't do evaluations. So we don't even know, for example, how many people are on electronic monitors in the US at any given moment. Nobody has that data, or the companies may have that data, but we can't access it even with Freedom of Information Act requests. So one of the real basic things in terms of fighting back against this is getting information so you can accurately figure out what's really taking place. I mean, for me, that's kind of a starting point. And the work that we've done, say, in the state of Illinois, where we tried to push for a legislation to eliminate electronic monitors, we found that we had to press the state to reveal who was on the monitor and what penalties they faced, et cetera, et cetera. So all these details are really difficult. I know you always say that activists must be nerds, right? So when you're fighting this stuff, you have to do research, and you find in this particular, with these particular technologies, the data is not easily accessible.
And I think it is true. Activists, throughout the history of liberation struggle, have been nerds. Spontaneity has its power and uses. However, the most successful large-scale changes come about because people have figured out what to do and do it. It doesn't mean they have to have PhDs or even be able to read, but rather be able to focus and think systematically about problems. So I was thinking as you were talking about the book that Vicki Law and Maya Shenwer published about a year and a half ago, called A Prison by Any Other Name, which also gives us some insights into the expansion of the police state into every corner of vulnerable people's lives. And I wonder whether the Lucy Parsons project or other projects that you know about have done the kinds of grassroots information gathering that can become the basis for a concerted struggle, whether it's struggling against the local police or against the state legislature and so forth. I'll give another example to maybe make this a bit more concrete. Some years ago in California, in rural California, in the part of California where they were building prison after prison after prison, there were all kinds of people, and as there still are, doing all kinds of work around questions of environmental justice, as well as economic justice. And we, prison abolitionists, learned pretty quickly that these movements actually were one. The movement against environmental racism, the movement for economic justice, and the movement to end prisons were one thing. And learned by learning side by side with our comrades in rural California how we could make that a reality. We learned from a small group of comrades, for example, who had been suffering the toxic atmosphere produced by a fire that had burned for more than a year, a fire where 40 million tires, like from automobiles, had been burning for more than a year. Our comrades from a small community realized that if they went door to door and asked people what their experience was of this toxic atmosphere that they were all breathing, that would form the basis for the next step in movement. Just to ask, what's your experience? So that's also the kind of nerd work. It's not only trying to find spreadsheets and do mathematical calculations, but also just systematically finding out what's going on. So do you have maybe some examples of that kind of nerd work?
Sure. I mean, I think from the start, focusing on electronic monitoring for a minute, and then I want to talk about some work around ending cash bail and pretrial detention. But we started from the beginning with the idea that if people were going to find out about the impact of electronic monitoring, we had to gather the stories of people who were on monitors because the authorities were keeping no data on this. So myself and the person that works with me primarily on this, Emmett Sanders, who himself was on a monitor after doing more than two decades in Illinois state prisons, we went around interviewing people in various places. We went to Chicago, we interviewed people in California, I interviewed people in Michigan, I interviewed people in Wisconsin, but we gathered their experiences of electronic monitors, and through that we were able to put together a picture of what electronic monitoring actually, how it impacted people. And we found that if we recorded these stories, that they became very powerful testimony, much more powerful actually than spreadsheets and all that stuff, which is important. But we kind of think the lived experience is the richest data, and then but you need the other, you need all of that together. So if we move that into the state, we put together a bill to eliminate the use of electronic monitoring for people coming out of prison in Illinois. And the people that were impacted went and testified in those hearings. And one woman whose son had been on electronic monitor came into the room with the box that her son had had for electronic monitoring and said, "Here, you left this thing in my house. You can have it back now." And then talked about how, you know, her son had a medical emergency and he couldn't get permission to leave. And she had to decide as a mother whether to violate him or not. But I'm just using that as an example to say these stories become very powerful. But if we move into Cook County, the Chicago Community Bond Fund, and later on the Illinois Coalition to End Money Bond, they started by collecting stories and by also mobilizing court watchers. So they trained court watchers to go into court and record what was happening in the courts to see if some of the reforms that had been put into place, to see if they were being followed. And then they produced periodic reports. And then they had all kinds of media, social media, op-eds, et cetera, constantly monitoring the sheriff and all of law enforcement in Cook County to see if they were actually reducing the jail population as they had promised and reducing the use of electronic monitoring and other punitive technologies. So they studied not only the jail population, but they studied electronic monitoring. They studied all the other conditions that were put on people as part of pretrial release. And they really became the experts on this, but they also were able to strategize in ways that ended up with the passage of the Pretrial Fairness Act in Illinois, which is the first piece of legislation in the United States to eliminate cash bail pretrial. So they did this through an abolitionist lens. So they were very careful about what they were willing to give up to get a law, to get a bill passed. So this is kind of the complicated issue that we face when we try to engage these things. Carve outs. Are we going to carve out people that have sex offense convictions? So we're going to let them rot, but we're going to let other people out. So these are some of the kind of difficult decisions that we face when we're trying to deal with this at a legislative level, but still maintain an abolitionist vision.
Mm-hmm. That's just great. And your detailed answer, which I'm really grateful for, gives the people who are listening to us today a sense of the kind of detailed work folks are doing there in Illinois and elsewhere that may or may not result in eventually a legislative victory, but is definitely expanding the ground for abolitionist organizing in general, or what I call making abolition geography. You remind me of a long process that some of us went through back in my days in California. At the very beginning of the 2000s, we, Critical Resistance, California Prison Moratorium Project, and one other organization, the Friends of the Kangaroo Rat, in fact, went up against the state of California to try to stop them from building their newest proposed prison. And it was in the context of that fight that we did that kind of urban-rural work that I described earlier, forming solidarity, not allies, solidarity, becoming one with people doing environmental racism work or anti-racism work in urban and rural areas, in economic justice, issues about immigration and migration, all of that, just putting it together. And at one point, we were making so much good noise and so much good trouble, as the late Representative Lewis might have said, that the then governor of the state decided to kind of shun us off to the side by looking like he was going to start a reform process that would dilute our more radical ideas. So we thought, well, let's see if we can get someone on this governor's commission to study mass incarceration, just so we can have a nagging voice at the left end of the table. So we kept faxing in my CV, and they obviously put it straight into the shredder. They didn't stop and even read it, because they weren't about to put any kind of representation from the abolitionists. So what we did was we said, well, they can have their commission. We'll start our own. So we formed what we called the Shadow Commission. And we announced hearings all over the state of California, which, as you know, is a big place. And we would just let it be known. We would go into common cause with people in urban and rural areas, in neighborhoods, in small towns, in bigger towns, explain what we were about, find the two or three people who are everywhere who are inclined to abolition, whether or not they call themselves abolitionists, and then announce that the commission, the shadow commission, is in town to hear what people had to say. And we were always packed. People came out to talk to us. And we always kept our promise, which was, we will gather what we hear and we will take it places where it could perhaps tip the scale, the balance of justice, but we can't promise anything other than we will not stop repeating what we've learned. And it sounds like this modality, which I know is one that has had a long history throughout all revolutionary movements, whether we look at Guinea-Bissau, whether we look at South Africa, whether we look at what the MST is doing in Brazil now, whether we look at what is happening in some of the really astonishing successes in India and beyond. It's always the same, which is ground up with an understanding of what the thing we're calling it the cloud today is. I wonder if we could talk for a little bit, zero in on some of these experiences and speak specifically to the fact that ankle shackles do turn people's homes into prisons and really put the cost of being unfree onto households and communities. I'm thinking about the mother that you described to us, who came with the box to the hearing to say, here, you can have this back. But thinking also about one of the effects of electronic carceral systems is that it is possible to compel households and communities to be unsworn deputies for the police. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
Oh, yeah. yeah, because so when I came home from prison, 2 days after, a woman employed by the Illinois Department of Corrections came and slapped that thing on my ankle. And as she closed the door to leave, my partner shouted all kinds of nasty things, which I won't repeat. But these people, you know, they're bringing this jail into your house, right? And then they told me that I was only going to be allowed out of the house from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. Monday through Friday. So that's where this book started. Right there at that moment, I said, what the hell? It's 4 hours a day. And that was very typical in Illinois at that time for people on parole. But I think your point is about, you know, families being impacted, that there's what I call the Martha Stewart model of electronic monitoring, whereas you're putting somebody on electronic monitor who lives on a 151-acre ranch, unlimited access to resources and all of the things that they need, so that they can be pretty comfortable under house arrest. But that's not who's under house arrest. Who's under house arrest is, you know, poor people, is Black and brown people in particular, in communities that are under-resourced. They may be living with 4, 5, 6, 8 family members in the same space. They may not be able to go out of that space. So their family members not only have to deal with the fact that this body is always here, and if it's somebody who's just done 10 years in prison, that's a body with a lot of issues, and you've got to deal with it. And so, but then you have some some rules for electronic monitoring say that you're only allowed to have movement to do laundry and grocery shopping if there's no one else living in your house that can do those tasks. So the gender implications of all of this are incredible, because we know that probably 85 to 90% of the people on, you know, on monitor are coming out of men's prisons and men's jails. So that means it's sisters, mothers, partners, et cetera, daughters that end up doing all of those tasks, as well as doing the jailing work, making sure the person doesn't go out. But also there's the whole set of counseling responsibilities that come with dealing with somebody who's actually caged in your house. You know, so this is something that judges never think of at all. The other part of that is the fact that sometimes people are put on house arrest in their family residence, which may be precisely the absolute worst place they could be put. And I think particularly of a woman I know from Charlotte, North Carolina, Christy Puckett Williams, who had a history of being abused by her partner, and also a history of substance use. And she was put on a monitor into that house where all that took place. So you're setting that up to be repeated. And I think that's most apparent when you have youth that are put on these devices, who are maybe put into a house where all kinds of stuff is happening, whether it's domestic conflict, whether it's substance use, whatever, and they can't escape it. They just have to sit there and wait for whatever is going to happen. So it really is a big part of what happens. And I think because of the gender implications of it, it's also off the radar. It's not even talked about by the decision makers in these things.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And indeed, even if somebody coming home goes into a situation in which their home becomes a jail, whether or not there's all kinds of other disruptive activity in the house, when the house becomes a jail, it's no longer home for anybody. So all tensions rise. If I'm understanding you, and I'm understanding what I read in your book, all tensions rise. The hidden money cost to people who are not only paying the cost of the device on their ankle, but paying all of the other costs to keep things together, then changes an entire social dynamic that could be all right or not, but won't be, because right, home has become not home. It's become this other thing.
And it also creates a dependency on the part of the person who's on the monitor, which makes them feel helpless. They can't contribute to the income. They can't do any of the tasks. They can't go to their children's school events. They can't do all kinds of things that they would want to be involved in to try to be human, right? And instead, they're just, you know, parked in that house. So there's all kinds of resentments that build up going both ways.
That was audio from Kiteline Radio, a weekly radio show based in the USA focusing on prison issues. They were airing clips from a talk by Ruth Wilson Gilmore and James Kilgore about Kilgore's book, Understanding E-carceration. To hear more from Kiteline, you can find them online at kitelineradio.org. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. Our last piece for today is a short interview with an organizer of a vigil that will be taking place on Sunday, February 13th at 12:30 at 1010 St. Antoine in Montreal. For those of you who did not hear, a migrant died in custody at the migrant prison in Laval last week. Solidarity Across Borders is calling the vigil, and they wrote on their website, quote, "Over the past 20 years, there have been at least 15 known deaths in CBSA custody, some due to suicide, some due to physical restraint, and others due to atrocious neglect. These deaths are emblematic of the violence of the Canadian immigration system. Far from an exceptional measure, detention serves to facilitate deportation and punish migrants for fleeing situations of poverty, violence, and exploitation. The fear of detention also forces migrants to live on the margins and confines them to exploitative and unsafe working conditions, and is one of the reasons that compels migrants and refugees to take even more dangerous, costly, and precarious routes to get to Canada. Join us for a vigil outside the CBSA offices to mourn this death and to honor all migrants who fight for their lives and their dignity in the face of a violent, unjust immigration system. You can read the entirety of their call out at solidarityacrossborders.org, but also here is our interview with Sarah, one of the organizers of the vigil. So we're talking to one of the organizers of a vigil that is happening on Sunday outside of the CBSA building at 1010 St. Antoine to commemorate and collectively mourn someone who died in the Immigration Detention Center in Laval on January 30th. Can you introduce yourself for our listeners?
Yeah, hi, my name is Sarah. I've been involved in Solidarity Across Border for the past 5 years. We're involved in supporting people inside while they're doing, for example, hunger strikes, or trying to fight for better conditions, and we also support them with goods and phone calls.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the context that led to you guys deciding to organize this vigil that's happening on Sunday?
Yeah, totally. Well, we feel that the death of that person, that we don't know the name, we don't know the age, we don't know nothing about that person, and is really f***ed up. CBSA is doing a really bad job about sharing information about that death. And we think that by doing that vigil is a way to break the isolation and to remember that death. There have been over 20 deaths in detention centers since the past 10 years. So people are dying at the end of the CBSA, and they don't take any responsibility for that. And so for us, it's really important to remember everyone that dead or living. And that's why we want to gather all together and not let forget any death that is happening in prisons and in detention centers.
Can you talk a little bit about what's going to happen at the vigil on Sunday?
Yeah, well, some people from Solidarity Across Borders are going to talk, share experiences. Like, people who have been through detention centers at prisons are going to share some words. We're going to remember also all the deaths that happened in the detention centers since the past 10 years. And we're going to talk a bit about Solidarity Across Borders and what we do, and why it is important to fight against prisons, against all form of prisons that include detention centers, and also to open the eyes that there's another detention center that is built a street from, like, not a street, but really close from the existing one, and we want to organize against that. We don't think that building new prison is a good response to the system we're living in. We are against prisons, so we want to gather, remember that debt, remember everyone that are incarcerated right now and still fight against prison.
The call out for the demo also mentioned that you wanted to mourn and commemorate the family who died trying to walk across the border out west a couple weeks ago. Can you talk a little bit about the situation? Is there information about the situation with people walking across the border? Like, what... do you have more to say about that situation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, with COVID situation, the Roxham Road have been blocked since, for a while during COVID. And they reopened it when they de-locked down a couple months ago. So many people cross, and now they're just blocking it again. So people are, to cross to Canada, people are taking really high risk, because Roxham Road is inaccessible to people right now. So, yeah, this family tried to cross by Manitoba, and they sadly died. And that's just one case that we know, but there's maybe other cases also. And, we don't have much information either about that family or how many people are crossing to come to Canada. But, of course, the fact that the borders are closed and really legalized, it doesn't help anyone to try to cross, and people are just, like, people are going to cross anyways. So now they're just taking more risk, and they're dying of cold.
Yeah. Do you have anything to say about trying to have practices of collective mourning, like as organizers, like trying to have spaces for getting together and commemorating the dead? Like, do you feel like it's something that we should be doing more of together? Are there like moments you can think of where people have gotten together and done a decent job of trying to do that more collectively instead of individually hearing about these deaths and kind of like dealing with them on our own?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And well, I think it's really important to get together and remember those dead, because prison is such a system that is trying to isolate you and make you feel that you're alone. And it's something that is so far from a lot of people and a lot of like people's reality. So I think bringing that down to the public space is really important, because people are human beings being incarcerated and being killed in jail. It's something we should fight, and there's no perfect way to do it, of course, but I think, as you said, like meeting them collectively and trying to remember people inside is a really important job that we have to do. And it's also a space for people that have been in jail to come back and to feel that there's like solidarity and there's people that are thinking about the folks inside. And I remember I've assisted too many New Year's noise demo also. That's a really good way to remember people that are inside, that we are also there, that they're not dying and no one cares. We cares, and we're trying to fight that system. And I think it's important to have spaces for, I don't know how to say it in English, but a day, the grieving, because there's many people around us that have lost family members in detention, or that people are in detention since so long, or in other countries also. So I think it's an important moment.
Well, just to repeat the information for anyone listening, the demo or the vigil is happening on Sunday at 12:30 p.m. at 1010 St. Antoine, which is the Canadian Border Services Agency's office in downtown Montreal. And anyone who wants to is welcome to come. Do you have anything you wanted to add that I didn't ask you about?
No, I hope people are going to come. We're going to meet up and remember those dead and fight against prison system.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com and prisonradioshow.libsyn.com. The Libsyn site is updated much more regularly than the WordPress site these days. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at Prison Radio Show, and parts of our show are also available through most podcasting apps. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday of the month at 11 a.m. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Friday, February 25th at 11 a.m. If you have any questions about anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you want to be involved in the show, definitely contact us. Our email is prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are especially encouraged to participate. You can also call us collect. We're at 514-876-3748. That'll work from Bordeaux or RDP prisons. And we're available through regular phone at 438-337-8423. If you're in prison, you can also send us mail. We're at the Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Virginia. I've been your host for today. Please stay tuned.
Yes, rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means. Do you? It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a man. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
Oh, the law. The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Venez prêter main forte à la campagne de vaccination contre la COVID-19. Nous recherchons des personnes pour administrer les vaccins, des préposés à l'entretien, des agents administratifs, des préposés à l'accueil et des agents de sécurité. Vous êtes étudiant, retraité, vaccinateur? Faites la différence et contribuez à améliorer la santé de la population en participant à cette opération d'envergure. Informez-vous et manifestez votre intérêt dès maintenant sur jecontribuecovid19.gouv.qc.ca. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
By stats, prison is a gold mine camp with no buybacks. Nigga, it's a wizard in the system holding all my blacks. It started in 1640, shackles around my ankles. Melanin meant that I can't go to schools or read, cause who's gonna serve my master? Also, the pastor described all my people as the sheep who exist to upkeep the land. We feed the economy, creep all the crops, but then feed on it modestly, consciously knowing you're lesser than. And lighter skin means that you're better now. So you in the house taking whips and probably dick, cause well, you a fetish now. Meanwhile, I'm grateful for all that I'm given. I'm picking this cotton in rhythm. I pray for a lot of the living. Escaping is probably a sin, and if God ever finds out that I want my freedom, well damn, then God's gonna call in the wrath. Two horses with opposite maps. Those nooses, they up in the trees and I'm hanging, but I'll never fall like my pants. Then came the 13th Amendment, written in 1865. It says, slavery is over. Acceptance, pay for doing crime. And then the things that they made illegal are things you associate with people who now education is.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, the territory also known as Chuchage or Munayang, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah De A, recording from home on Thursday, February 10th, 2022. On tonight's show, my guests. Geordie's new artistic director, Jimmy Blay, launches the second virtual edition of Geordie Fest with the play he directed. Lots of fun stuff for your family this weekend.
You know, I started my career with Geordie, and to go back to the tour where I started and direct a show, it means a lot.
Noel Vezina of Studio 303 on the special space of Queer Performance Camp.
Montreal doesn't really have a dedicated space for queer artists. And, you know, a lot of places have a lot of different programming that is welcome to them, of course, but having a time that is specifically dedicated to centering this group of people and their unique identities and experiences just creates really rich exchange and creates atmospheres where people are more comfortable maybe.
And put a little bit of Montreal theater on your bookshelf. Zach Fraser on Infinitheater launching an in-house publishing press for Quebec plays.
The actors in the schools even here around Montreal, they don't even necessarily always know their local playwrights. And they're not even aware of the work that's happening around them because if, so long as it just lives as a manuscript and not a published piece, it's hard for them to get access to that work.